thank you to everyone who's passing on their Easter greetings. It's just these small things that do us all so good right now, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you for that. Susan Murphy is going to join us now. She's got a reflection and some words on Mary's lament, I believe it is. Susan, take it away.
Oh, Lord, the last few weeks have been like no other. I don't know how I've got through them. And now, this. My life just 3 years ago had been on its end. I felt shame, such deep sadness in myself. I had no one to really love, and I thought I would never again. And then he came into my life. Not like any other man, but one who saw into my soul. His words were like balm for my deep inner wounds. He actually saw me. He clothed me. Oh, he loved me. I gave up the little I had to follow him and his disciples. He talked of glory and of victory, but he said we really didn't understand. He told us the stories of fathers who ran to welcome back sons who had run away with the family's fortune, but he said we really didn't understand. He told us to love our enemies, to offer the other cheek, and he said we really didn't understand. We all sang together, we drank together, we shared what we had all together. We held each other with a joy that I thought was impossible. We walked hundreds of miles, we met thousands of people. We fed the hungry. Oh, we healed the sick. Oh, what a time we had. I have never felt so alive, so needed, oh, so loved. But how quickly things seem to turn in these last few weeks. He always said we didn't understand, but he knew that this time was coming. He felt alone. He felt we really didn't understand. He wanted us to keep watch, and we couldn't even stay awake. He knew he would be betrayed, dragged away, humiliated, tortured, and then crucified. Oh, he was alone on that cross, and there was nothing we could do. I watched him die in such agony. It didn't make sense. I don't understand. I know all the stories of so many others in the past, the plagues, the famines, the exodus. I know how my people have suffered. And yet all I feel now is that in my own heart, it has been ripped from my body and no other has felt so wounded and so alone. All I wanted was one more time to touch his body. His lifeless body, to give him the decency that he gave me. And yet here I am now, and the tomb is empty. He is gone. My heart is breaking. Oh, I just wanted one more time to touch him. I cannot bear it. I am alone once more. How will I live without him? How can I go on in hope if he is no longer living? Sir, Gardener, do you know where they have taken his body? How do you know my name?
Oh, thank you for that, Susan. Wonderful reflection on Mary's reaction to the empty tomb. He is risen. So hard to know what to say this Easter because it feels like we're stuck in Good Friday together. And you know me, I like my Easters loud and I like them celebratory. But that doesn't feel particularly or entirely right this year. So what to say? a little different this year, but allow me a story, a parable of sorts, if you will. 6 days before Easter 2019, it's a Monday morning, and I've just spent a few hours working on my Easter sermon for that year, and after a quick but late lunch, I find myself scrolling through Facebook when a post catches my attention. Notre Dame is on fire. A quick Google search reveals the post is no hoax, and with that, my afternoon plans take a back seat. I hate CNN on most days, but whenever there's some kind of world event occurring, we tend to spend a lot of time together. So rushing to my television, I turn it on, and sure enough, there it was, Our Lady, Notre Dame burning in front of our eyes. I sat staring in horror for the next few hours while CNN droned on and on, trying to find a new angle to the story. For a good half hour, news anchors are weighing in on the pros and cons of Donald Trump's idea to send aerial firefighting planes to douse the cathedral. And between texting with friends and my eyes fixed on the screen, I didn't move from the TV for hours. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I hadn't watched the news that closely, I think, since 9/11. But here I was once again, this time watching a beautiful cathedral go up in smoke. The French news magazine Paris Match would say, "Today they weep for her in every language." Ken Follett, author of Pillars of the Earth, an expert on Gothic cathedrals, he wrote this. "The voice on the phone was urgent. I'm in Paris," it said. "Turn on your television." You know what we saw on the screen, the wonderful cathedral of Notre Dame de Paris, one of the greatest achievements of European civilization, was on fire. The scene dazed and disturbed us profoundly. I was on the verge of tears. Something priceless was dying in front of our eyes. The feeling was bewildering, as if the earth was shaking. That afternoon and into the night, I couldn't look away. I watched with millions of others around the world as it burned, and at first I was simply in shock, but it wasn't until the 750-ton spire, already engulfed in flames, finally collapsed. It wasn't until that moment that I realized just how dreadful this was, and from that point on, I watched desperately, hoping at least some of the building would be spared. I feared the building would be lost forever. If you've ever been to Notre Dame in Paris, you will know that standing inside of it, it feels like you've entered this eternal space. Believe it or not, it's hard to stand inside her and not feel something. The cathedral was built on a small island in the middle of the Seine River in Paris. Construction began in 1163 during the reign of King Louis VII, and it was completed in 1345. I mean, just think about that. Notre Dame took 182 years to build. And once completed, it was considered the jewel of medieval Gothic architecture. It was said, in fact, that the builders and craftsmen who constructed her believed that she would last until Judgment Day. 182 years of work burning. It just didn't seem possible, but there we all were, watching it disappear in real time. And suddenly, the fragility of the building became obvious. Everything was on fire. Would anything be left? You know, I absolutely love Paris. As part of my European backpacking adventures, I had the opportunity to spend a week in Paris, the City of Lights, in May of 2000. And I immediately fell in love with the city. Hopping around that city for a week, my friend Dan and I, we started every day with buying a baguette and some cheese, just enough to snack on during the day, hold us over until dinner. And it was also the first time in my life I ever enjoyed wine. Dining in Paris, we would sit down and the waitstaff, they wouldn't even ask. They would just pour us a glass of wine as we sat down, as if it was water. I mean, I felt like, what utopian paradise have I found myself in? Our first night there, the two of us, we bought the best two bottles of wine we could afford on a backpacker budget, which is to say it wasn't so great. but we didn't know it at the time. We were only 20, so armed with our presumably bad wine, we set off on foot for the ground surrounding the Eiffel Tower and enjoyed our bottles as the tower sparkled in the night. We were there in France and Paris. In the next week was a whirlwind of tourist sights, lazy afternoons at the cafes that litter the streets of Paris, followed by nights of unbridled enthusiasm and revelry. Paris really might be the most beautiful city in the world. Barely out of high school, I suppose I was just doing the cliche thing, trying to find myself, my place in the world. I had left the lucrative and glamorous world of the mail industry to take this trip. What I would do after, I didn't know. Thoughts of going to school for journalism, but then again, maybe I'd just work and keep traveling. This trip was about fun and exploring the world, but it was also about trying to find my way, scratching some kind of itch before finding myself in the adult world, I guess you could say. Perhaps traveling to Europe would help. Maybe I'd find a sign. Maybe I'd find some kind of direction that would click for me. I didn't know what I was looking for. I just thought maybe Europe would help. And when you're walking Paris city streets, it can often make you feel like you just found yourself on the set of some romantic film. But while you walk the streets, there's also this palpable sense of the secularity of the culture. I mean, sure, there are medieval cathedrals are still present. There are nods to faith of a past, but any sign of contemporary faith, if there were any, were nowhere to be seen. Paris is, of course, where some argue modern atheism and Western secularism were born. It is, after all, the home of the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, Voltaire, Sartre. And yet, as secular as the city is, tourists flock to Notre Dame. It's the most visited monument in all of Paris, or so I'm told. As a tourist, it's just one of those places you just have to see while in Paris. And most come to it, of course, not for any religious or spiritual reason, but out of a curiosity, I suppose, looking for beauty. The architecture, the bells, the spire, the gargoyles, the lore stories of a hunchback. For me, I'm not really sure why I went. Part tourist duty, I suppose, much the same way as you must see the Mona Lisa in the Louvre, even though the experience will leave you cold and hating all tourists, including yourself. So I suppose part of it was that I was under the spell of tourism, but there was also something more, something I can't fully describe or put into words. Now, I've told you all far too many times at this point in our history together about my rather harrowing experience while heading to Notre Dame. I'm sure I don't need to remind you all of the time I played a rather critical role in stopping a purse thief, so I won't bore you now with tales of my own heroics. But after the purse thief incident, I was full of adrenaline. Dan and I, our bodies were pulsing with this energy, and it was like, should we just go and grab a glass of wine somewhere? But it was like, no, we gotta carry on. We plowed on. Still unsure why I was so interested in visiting some old church. And then there she was. From the outside, she looks like many a cathedral, I suppose, but to enter her doors was to enter what felt like another world. Words sort of fail me. But the beauty inside of her was transcendent. I took a seat in a pew and I just sat half an hour, maybe more, absorbing the Christian stories told by centuries of stained glass, art, and sculptures. My pounding heart slowed into a trance-like rhythm. You all know my story. I had come out of a fundamentalist church upbringing, and when that fell apart, our family ditched church altogether for a couple of years. It was during those years that I found myself in Europe, and it was there, sitting in a pew in Notre Dame, the light of stained glass reflecting the stories of the Christian faith all around me, that I realized I still believe it. I still believe the story. A story that had inspired the cathedral I now found myself in. A night later, on an overnight train ride out of Paris, my friend Dan would suggest I become a pastor, a priest, whatever you want to call it. And until Paris, the thought had never crossed my mind, but somewhere between Notre Dame and the train ride to Nice, France, kind of lodged itself. I couldn't shake it. And then leaving Nice and heading to Rome, Dan and I found ourselves sharing a couchette in an overnight train. It's a small room in a train with six beds, three sort of bunk beds on each side. And we found ourselves sharing one with three nuns and a priest. A bit of an awkward sleep, you could say, sleeping with nuns. But as morning came and our train pulled into Rome, Dan joked that spending the night on a train with nuns and priests, it must be a sign. Maybe I should become a priest. That thought lasted all of 2 seconds. I'm far too earthy, too sensual for a life of celibacy, but a pastor? Maybe. Just maybe. I don't know what happened to me in Notre Dame. Maybe nothing. Maybe I felt what everyone does inside its walls. Maybe something more. Start of a journey back to faith. But I felt something on the way out. I picked up a rosary. I wanted something to remind me of that moment. And emerging back into the light of day after our visit, I was struck by something. See, beyond the lines of tourists waiting to get in and those posing for selfies in the days where that meant asking someone to take a picture of you, I couldn't help but notice how many citizens of Paris just seemed to casually stroll by their enchanted cathedral. For the average Parisian in the city, they walk past Notre Dame without so much as a glance. A sort of indifference, you could say. Which feels a lot to me like how Christianity is treated these days in this, our secular age. Most people just walk by. Rather indifferent to it all. But on the night Our Lady Notre Dame burned, well, that night was different. The Parisians who normally walk and bike by it on their way to work and back home know that night, April 15th, 2019, the citizens of Paris, they gathered around the old cathedral and held a candlelight vigil for her. We've seen the sort of things for celebrities, most recently Kobe Bryant, but a candlelight vigil for a building? That I've never seen. Something different was going on that night. You see, despite the deep secularity of Paris, no one cheered or applauded as Notre Dame burned. There was nobody shouting, "Burn, baby, burn," no tweeting or posting about this being a good thing. No, there was none of that. Instead, what we saw across our television screens were the faces of Paris citizens weeping. What we saw was a deep shock in the eyes of a city's citizens. Some circles of folks began singing hymns, others just staring, dazed, confused, weeping as they watched their cathedral burn. And my hunch is this. Most of the people in Paris didn't realize how much they loved Notre Dame until they saw it in flames. And I can't blame them. It would be easy, I suppose, living in Paris to take it for granted, even to ignore it. But for them, they just didn't realize how much they loved it until it was almost gone. For most of the people of Paris and around the world, we just assumed the old cathedral would always be there if you ever decided you wanted to visit her. She'll always be around, we thought. But now the opportunity was gone. And of course, over the following days, some outrage was sparked online when people realized how much money billionaires were promising to help rebuild her. Think about where else that money could be spent, people would later scream. It's just a building. But was it just a building? I mean, buildings burn every day. Most of them don't cause the world to weep. As pragmatic as we might be in life, as cold as we might be to the inherent value of beauty, even those of us who see no value in art, I mean, even we know a warehouse on fire is not the same thing as a cathedral on fire. I mean, people wouldn't hold candlelight vigils or sing hymns if Walmart was on fire. A Walmart building in flames is not the same thing as Notre Dame. We know that deep down, we do. Because you see, even in our secular age, suspicious as we are of the sacred and religious, I think deep down we still know some things really are sacred. Apparently, though, we don't know how sacred some things are until they're on fire. And on that day, my suspicion is that most of the people of Paris, they didn't really know how much they loved their cathedral until they saw it on fire. This Easter will perhaps be the most muted Easter celebration we may ever know in our lifetime. It's hard to feel the joy of Easter stuck in isolation, the world itself having changed so quickly, but the reason I tell the Notre Dame story this morning is because I suspect that, like Parisians before the cathedral fire, there are many of us who for years have strolled by the Easter story without a glance or notice. Perhaps we've taken the Easter story for granted, indifferent to it for a while now. Perhaps there are even some who have thought they're done with it. Done with enchanted tales of a dead man returning to life. But this year I can't help but wonder. Perhaps we're not as done with it as we think we are. I think most people deep down, they don't really want to live in a world devoid of the communities that are trying to preserve the Easter story in the beauty of Jesus' path. And sure, we may critique the church. I know many who are completely done with it. In our anger, I even know those who would scream, empty the pews and let it burn. But do we really think the world would be a better place without the story of Jesus? Without Easter? Do we want a world without the Beatitudes, those blessings for the least of us? Do we really want to quiet the Sermon on the Mount? Do we want a world without the reminder to love our enemies and to keep from judging others? Do we really want a world without the story of the prodigal son? Would our world really be better without Christmas and Easter? Would our lives be better if we let our Christian faith burn to the ground? Do we want a world without an empty tomb? A world without resurrection? I hope to someday return to Paris. Kristen and I have long dreamed of being there together. But even if that should happen someday, it won't be the Paris I knew. You see, Paris is not better without Notre Dame, and our world is not better without the Christian faith. A world is not better without Easter. And while this year feels different, perhaps we need it now more than ever. I know many people who've abandoned the cathedral of our faith, walk by it now with indifference. Others seem to be torching it from the inside, but is that really what we want? Paris is not better without Notre Dame. Our world is not better without our faith. Our faith tells a story of Jesus, his life, his teachings, his healings, his stories, his death on a cross. But most importantly, on that third day, he rose from the grave, victorious over that death. That story, our story, is the story of hope. And maybe we've become indifferent to it all. Maybe we've taken it for granted. But I'm not sure our lives or our world would be better off without it. April 15th, 2019, Notre Dame burned, and we watched into the night hoping that something of her might be saved, something might be salvaged. And thankfully, the worst of outcomes didn't happen. Notre Dame was ruined and scarred, but not entirely lost. Our Lady did not completely perish in the flames, but it came close. You know, the New York Times reported later that the cathedral came within 20 minutes of being completely lost. on the scene, the bell towers had been caught in flames. It was a volatile situation. And watching on TV, you could see the smoke billowing out of the bell towers. Towers, of course, made of a whole lot of ancient wood. It was perilous for anyone to try to enter the building. One team of firefighters refused. It was too dangerous. But there was another team of firefighters on hand that night. That team volunteered to enter the flames. Up, up, up the spiral staircases they went, carrying their fire hoses. 20 minutes delay, the whole thing would have been lost. The heroic actions of those firefighters who risked their lives had it so that Notre Dame was saved. Damaged, yes, years of rebuilding ahead, yes, but not lost forever. One of the most iconic photos of the Notre Dame fire was taken inside the cathedral the morning after the blaze. It was a photo taken of something I had also taken a photo of 19 years ago. My photo doesn't do it justice, but perhaps you can make out the scene. It's the depiction of the Virgin Mary holding Jesus' body after he's come down from the cross dead. Above it stands a large golden cross, and I can't remember for the life of me why I took that photo. You have to remember in those days, we still had just 24 pictures on a roll of film. I'm not sure why I wanted that image to be one of them. I don't recall. But I recall the way that building felt, how it moved me. Something about this altar must have caught my attention at the time. I don't recall what, but the image of it taken the morning after the fire certainly resonated with me. Here's the photo of the morning after. In the foreground, we see the charred beams from the collapsed roof lying between the pew benches and the altar. On the high altar, we see here more clearly the marble statue of the Virgin Mary holding the lifeless body of Christ after the crucifixion. And above the marble statue is that large golden cross, reflecting the light pouring now into the roofless building. And there it stands, triumphant, it would seem, over the wreckage. Behind the cross, the stained glass windows at the east end of the cathedral aglow with the light of sunrise. To me, that photo bears testimony to the devastating catastrophe, and yet it's still bursting with hope. The night before, everything was on fire, but as the sun rises, Our Lady, she still stands. The cross still shines, and rays of hope illuminate that sacred place. The world feels on fire. Our faith feels on fire. What can we do? I mean, in times like this, it's helpful to know that not all beliefs are the same. Some deserve to be condemned. Some need to be deconstructed, let go, thrown out. Some are quite simply not worth saving, but other beliefs are worth risking everything for in order to try to save them. Notre Dame changed something in me. I can't quite say how or what, but something happened there. I know stories of people who've come to believe in Jesus simply by visiting Notre Dame. I mean, any building that can have that kind of effect is worth saving. But if a cathedral that was inspired by and built to the glory of the Christian faith is worth saving and holding on to, how much more is the faith itself worth saving? The cathedral that is the Christian path has stood for over 2,000 years. It's flooded the world with beauty and love, in faith and hope. And it's worth saving. It's worth holding on to. Yes, there are some renovations that are long overdue, some things that just need to be moved to the trash, but we can't let it burn all down. It's worth saving. And it's worth holding on to. This morning, in this time and place, chief among those things worth saving and holding on to is this, 1 Corinthians 15:3. For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures. Jesus was raised from the dead. The tomb is empty. He is alive and now stands as the hope of the world. All that he taught, all that he did, all that he showed us now stands as where the future is heading. He has risen. not just metaphorically, not just archetypally, not just narratively. He lives and is risen and is the first fruits of a world waiting in hope for resurrection as well. Still remember, it sticks out to me, a number of Easters ago, I got a text after that Sunday, that Easter Sunday afternoon, with someone who said this: "I loved your Easter message this morning, Brad, until the part where you insisted Jesus' resurrection was real. It has been really bothering me all day. Why can't Jesus' resurrection be figurative, an idea that speaks of new beginnings?" I'll never forget the text because I get it. I mean, I too love the idea of new beginnings. I mean, who doesn't love the idea that our marriages could be metaphorically resurrected, or our careers could find resurrection, or that on some personal level, I might find some kind of resurrection of my self-esteem? Those are great things, God things even, but I don't need figurative hope. I need real hope, physical hope for both myself and this world, because if it didn't happen, well, to borrow the words of Flannery O'Connor, if it's a symbol, to hell with it. 1 Thessalonians 4, "But we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about those who have died, so that you may not grieve as others do who have no hope. For we believe that Jesus died and rose again." Christians don't grieve in the face of death as others do, Paul says, because we have hope in the resurrection. Physical resurrection, a dead body finding life and breath again. John Updike, in his poem, Seven Stanzas at Easter, he says this: "If Jesus' cells dissolution did not reverse, the molecules reknit, the amino acids rekindled, the church will fall." We so struggle today with the disenchantment of our faith. In that, I feel like we're the fire crew, too scared to climb the spiral staircase and save what is worth saving. We have too many doubts and skepticism around the enchanted aspects of faith. Believe in kumbaya love? Sure. Believe in actual resurrection? I don't know. And all the while, we're like Parisians watching their cathedral burn. But it's worth saving. It's worth protecting. It's worth holding on to. Because I believe the Christian path must be driven by a deep theology of hope. It must be rooted in a very real hope and expectation of a new heavens and new earth, where all is made new, where all tears are wiped away, where death is vanquished forever. And if the Christian path is not that, if the Christian path is unable to console and comfort us in the face of hard lament and hard times and suffering, if it can't give us confidence and patience while we wait, then what's the point? But it's not too late, even now. It's not too late for hope, for trust. For some of us, our faith has been on fire for years. For others, perhaps the recent events the world is going through has shaken our faith, perhaps for the first time. And I get that. But I believe some things are worth saving. Some things that must be saved, because would we really be better off without it? The resurrection of Jesus asks us to trust that every scream, every tear, every cry of panic, every sleepless night in anxiety will be redeemed. The resurrection of Jesus asks us to trust that God's laughter is stronger than death, stronger than viruses, stronger than our fragile hearts, and stronger than our fragile economy. The resurrection of Jesus asks us to trust that where we are now is not our last chapter. And that whatever pain, suffering, or humiliation we are facing, the story is not done. The resurrection of Jesus asks us to trust that God has not given up on the world, because this world matters. And Jesus' resurrection announces that God has not given up on you, because you matter. This world, your life, God will redeem, restore, renew, resurrect it all. No matter how dark it seems, no matter how alone and isolated we feel in all of this, it won't last. Because what God did for Jesus on Easter morning, he's going to do for us and for the world. And this idea, this faith, this is worth saving. This is worth holding on to. Last night, I received an email from an old friend, Herb Spencer. He sent me the most wonderful Easter reflection from Tish Warren, author of Liturgy of the Ordinary. And I wish I had got it 2 days ago. I might have just read the whole thing to you, but she captures something so profound. I didn't even have time to get it in the slides, but this is what she says. I am a Christian because I believe in the resurrection. If it isn't true, to hell with it. But if it is true, then the resurrection of Jesus is the most determinative fact of the universe, the center point of history. The resurrection is ultimately truer and more lasting than death or destruction, violence or viruses. It's truer, too, than our celebration of it, however beautiful, however meager. The truest fact of the universe this Eastertide is not death tolls, empty sanctuaries, or overcrowded hospitals. The truest fact of the universe is an empty tomb. The resurrection is the only evidence that love triumphs over death, weakness prevails over strength, and beauty outlives ashes. If Jesus is risen in actual history with all the palpability of flesh, finger, bone, and blood, there is hope that our mourning will be comforted and that death will not have the final word. Jesus' friends arrive at his tomb that Easter morning, and they're told he isn't here. He is risen, and there's nothing to fear. And Jesus' Easter announcement is this: they can take my life and I will die, but that will not be the end. That's not the end of the story, because God is in the business of bringing what was dead back to life. That's the hope of the Christian path. That's the hope of our faith this Easter, this day. And friends, it's worth saving. It's worth holding on to. May you find this Easter in the midst of all of this, some semblance of that. May you cling to the hope of the resurrection.